If you want to take part in the Christmas card stream, now is the last chance for your card to arrive in time. Don't delay.
Understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2025 for what I believe is the ninth night, yes it is, and four interviews. In 2 hours it'll be Dave Riley, and then Sam Dixon, and then Stefan Verstappen. But first, I'm here with Michael Reyners. Michael Reyners is, will be known to some of you, became prominent on the scene this year with The Restorationist, and is now starting a new project. So, Michael, please introduce yourself to the audience. And welcome to Millennial. This is another debut, so welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. And yes, I think you've summarised roughly when I popped up, which is in the last year or so. Firstly, through doing a variety of commentaries in some publications on the dire and increasingly strange and averse to the ordinary man speech landscape that we have in this country, and later seeking to do something about that, something which would be a bit more long form and that many publications wouldn't be willing to publish, I started my own project, which was The Restorationist, now defunct, and I'm going on to reboot that project as reyners.org.uk this coming year. I identified a few things that are really the core surgically fixable problems in terms of legislation that Britain is facing, and why not put those solutions directly out there in such a way that it makes think tanks and the state think, perhaps, well, why aren't we doing more? And I would say, if they could possibly get to the sort of pace of the industriousness that you have been interviewing people with over the Christmas period, then perhaps they might be close. But for the time being, it seems that solo practitioners who have a legal background, such as myself, are way ahead of a lot of these think tanks by a substantial margin, and certainly by the state, who seems complacent about it. So that is my sort of crusade, if you will, sorting things out by offering draft bills to solve what I see to be quite simple problems.
All right, but simple problems that have terrible consequences, of course, drastic consequences. What would you say to the idea that a lot of this, I mean, obviously it goes back a long, long way, but a lot of it stepped up with Tony Blair in 1997, who was a lawyer, and I think a lot of his cabinet were former lawyers, and either way, they embarked on a project to really reshape the constitution of the country, and part of that was bringing in a huge number of new laws. I can't remember what the number was. There was some astonishing number I saw. Like, the New Labour brought in more laws in their term than in the entire century that preceded them, something like that.
Legislative,
I can't remember now.
Production that they are and remain unparalleled, and they set the tone for coalition and then the Conservatives stewarding things after them. But truly, I think Blair's idea when it came to whipping Parliament was just to legislate first and ask questions later. I don't have the number off the top of my head, but it is unprecedented before or since in terms of the amount of legislation, both primary and secondary. And the effect of that, I think, is that we did have a historic constitution that people point to the more famous and historic parts of it, be they Magna Carta or the Bill of Rights. You know, these are many centuries old. But the actual fabric of our constitution is, because no parliament can bind a successor, whatever you've put in place within the last parliament, realistically. And Blair decided we're going to do as much of baking in legislation as possible. And therefore, some of it was quite radical, deliberately unconstitutional, like the Constitutional Reform Act of 2005. But our constitution is shattered into 1,000 pieces of legislation and hidden from the ordinary man in a way that you don't get in America, because, of course, it's hyper-accessible there. You know your amendments. It's almost a civic duty to know these things and be able to produce them when an officer of the state tries to do anything to you. Here, we do not have that. And therefore, that bloat of legislation from 97 onwards fundamentally reshaped our constitution without necessarily announcing it was doing it. And it baked in a lot of assumptions that Tony Blair and his various legal friends found to be fashionable. Firstly, sort of internationalism. Secondly, this idea of a governance from a political centre that should be maintained through whatever means necessary. And they did that quite sophisticatedly. Thirdly, that Parliament should be weakened. And by deferring its powers downwards through devolution and into local councils, and later what we see with the mayoral things, the creation of mayoral seats, we've seen that project continue. So downwards, outwards, which is to weaken it by its the institutions that would generally assist it, be they the bar or the judiciary, the bar and the law society, were all brought under the statehood in a way that they hadn't been previously. And normally you would get parliamentarians over the last century would be lawyers, and they would sit in the evenings, you know, they would have a day job. Those people could no longer quite be political in their private and professional lives anymore, because they brought in about 93 regulators as well during that period for all professions. And this weakened Parliament, I think, laterally. And then upwards towards deference to the UN's kind of directives and deference to the European Union, which, of course, was getting into swing. So he weakened Parliament. He altered our constitution fundamentally by producing such a large amount of legislation that nobody would even be able to point to the constitutional changes, apart from maybe the Constitutional Reform Act is the obvious candidate, and devolution and the Human Rights Act. But he altered the constitution, weakened our parliament, and then baked in this through the creation of so many regulators, of both MPs all the way down to care workers, including the press, of course, baked in a permanent governance from the centre. And the idea was, as a lawyer and a sensible and quite revolutionary one in this way, Blair hoped to say, well, through legislation, we can make ourselves inevitable on a permanent basis. And that is exactly why every subsequent government has danced to this tune.
Yeah, the country is now full of little Blairs who essentially carrying on his work 20, 25 years after him. There was a couple of things I wanted to pick up on there. That what you said about America versus Britain in terms of awareness of our constitutional infrastructure. You're absolutely right, of course, that Americans, they know the amendments, all of them. They know the Declaration of Independence and so forth. In Britain, I think we really just took all of this stuff for granted. It was sort of organic, and we didn't need to know this or that bit of legislation. We just sort of instinctively knew our rights, and those were very expansive, especially the right to freedom of speech. It was just there. It was just it was by nature. An Englishman could say whatever he liked, and so could a Scotsman for that matter. We didn't need to know the legislation, and so we in a sense that makes you very complacent, but it also is a sort of faith in your country and your national environment. That's one thing. The other thing I wanted to say was And this is something that I think a lot, it confuses a lot of people about New Labour, about the Blair Revolution, as it were, that it was centralising, but it was centralising through decentralising. And so you get all these, as you say, mayoral seats, you get all these NGOs, and devolution, of course, of Scotland and Wales. You think that's going to be, oh, more local. Well, it's going to be power should will be where it should be, as but the actually the opposite has happened. I mean, all of these places are sort of paper, like just talking shops. I mean, the less said about the Scottish Parliament, the better. Just awful and controlled,
Architecturally,
really.
a very beautiful building, of course, that they chose.
The original, the temporary one was prettier than the one they
Yes.
built for it at an enormous expense, and it wasn't even a Scottish architect; it was a Spaniard. But that's by the
It
by.
looks a little bit like the Bilbao Museum of Modern Art, actually, but like somebody has run it, pulsed it through a blender. I think
It was.
Scotland has some finer buildings of its own
Oh
construction
yeah.
that could have been offered up. Anyway, sorry, I'm
Absolutely.
distracting you.
Absolutely. But that's kind of relevant though, because it speaks to them of the mentality that we're talking about, where it's a hideous building, hugely expensive, and not even designed by a person from the ethnic group that it's supposedly going to be serving. I mean, it's absurd. And then you populate it with imbeciles. That's an interesting story with the Scottish Parliament, because it started off quite well for just a couple of years. It was actual statesmen, it was proper politicians, and
It had
very
some wins
rapidly.
as well, actually,
To,
with local policy and policing and trying to make the courts a little more efficient. But I don't see much of that now. And it has fallen into this, I think, a deliberate form of paralysis. It provides the diagnostic tools to have people lobby a more local parliament and identify issues at a greater granularity. But by giving those powers away from a centralized parliament actually prevents it having the tools to solve any of them. And therein lies the problem, but that also is part of the design, I think, of devolution, both in councils, both in the devolved nations, and then also with the London Authority Act in 1999, and later the mayoral stuff, but that is passed, that's well into the Conservatives' stewardship of state, that they continue that. But it puts diagnostic tools there and doesn't provide the ability to solve the things you're diagnosing.
And also just the caliber of person, I think is lamentable. But the Yeah, so that it's this weird paradox where they centralized by decentralizing. Could you talk about, I mean, first of all, do you agree with that statement? I don't want to rope you into something.
Yeah, I do. And I would phrase it as follows: is that by decentralizing things and stripping institutions of their power, but simultaneously requiring them to operate by protocol, you have to remember that devolution is in the time of the Human Rights Act, in the time of essentially making that the protocol for importing the ECHR at all levels of state operation. What can and can't happen in the public sector is heavily determined by that. That makes things more protocolic. But it's also a deference to this external charter. It's you're spreading power around, so it is less useful, and obliging it to operate in certain highly protocolic ways that are more on the rails than previous sort of parliaments doing one thing or the next. And on a devolution level, the downwards weakening effect of parliament, as I tend to call it, that was a very useful way of making a variety of fairly impotent bodies, but they are also very much beholden to a charter written in the 1950s with the purpose of preventing states from engaging in human rights violations. That is then baked in into these devolved councils and parliaments in such a way that they are more predictable in what they do and what they can do. That is entirely by design, I think. And successive governments have been delighted by this project because essentially it means that the civil service has less work. Therefore, they can say, well, we've made savings on this, and we might even cut a bit of it at some point. Government itself has less work. Parliament has less work, obviously, because these things are devolved in an upwards or a downwards direction. And they're all quite content with that. With the upward stuff with the EU and the ECHR, it provides a retirement scheme for both judges and some parliamentarians and devolved parliamentarians as well, that they go into the European Parliament, and that was stripped from them. So given that they're all dancing by the same sort of protocol, formally, the European Court of Justice's say-so, which held itself above our Parliament, and now, after having exited the European Union, still the ECHR's say-so, because it is baked in via the Human Rights Act, you end up with actually quite a lot of bodies who have had things delegated to them that all converge on the same points. And those points aren't particularly active, and they're generally quite comfortable in the way that a footballer goes to retire in a European club kind of thing. It was convenient to a class of people, I would say, but it's been hellishly inconvenient for attempting to undo this situation.
Yeah. The European Court of Human Rights is a good example, because that, of course, is the basis for why we have to take in all these asylum seekers and refugees. It's why we have to put them up in hotels, and everything that we have to do for them is justified by the Refugee Convention, which ratified by the European Court of Human Rights, which even despite Brexit, we can't exit because of the Human Rights Act. Is that correct?
Yeah. So it's somewhat correct. We had in 1981 the British Nationality Act, which removed the ability to have birthright citizenship. It's the same conversation occurring in America now as to whether those who come across the southern border can give birth on American soil and therefore call themselves American citizens. And of course, they're challenging that conception, and there's a lot of hysteria about it. We challenged that conception in 1981 after having fumbled our empire and then fumbled the roles of citizens domestically by offering citizenship and voting rights to our imperial territories. In 1981, we say, okay, you can't be born here and claim citizenship just off the basis of jus soli, the sort of right of the soil that is still normal in America. Instead, you will it will have to be passed down through citizenship holders as it is, or acquired through a naturalization process. What the the European Court of Human Rights and the Human Rights Act have created is we've regained jus soli, where actually if you come here illegally, or you outstay a visa, or you claim asylum and then arrive here, after 5 years, you can claim indefinite leave to remain. And that means you've basically got an immediate track to citizenship. And that would probably be fine if we could remove people who had arrived here illegally, for example, or had outstayed visas. And the vast majority of people who do end up naturalizing via this route do outstay visas. The Home Office don't know how many people are even outstaying their visas at this point. They don't keep numbers on it. But you can't remove them because of their right to, for example, a family life or a private life, and various things that the Human Rights Act baked in 1998. So you can come here illegally. You can't be removed via this particular instrument made in 1998. And as a result, you're obliged to be given an offer of citizenship after 5 years. There's a sense of great injustice about this. And even Tony Blair's own government was distraught by this and attempted to reduce the amount of time for indefinite leave to remain, for it to be granted. To increase the amount of time for indefinite leave to remain, being granted. Because indefinite leave to remain, as the name implies, means you can indefinitely remain here with no particular conditions, and you may apply for citizenship. They wanted to extend it. There was a challenge in about, I believe it was about 2004, that led to a bit of a scaredy-cat moment from the Home Office. And that is responsible for them not wanting to put up indefinite leave to remain now. But coming back round to the point is that we got rid of the ability to come here, have children and claim to be British in 1981. But then we reinstated it fundamentally through the Human Rights Act, which just prevented anyone ever being able to be removed within that kind of time frame. So we have de facto just solely citizenship in this country by way of that act.
Just as an aside, that came in 1998. New Labour started in May 97. So I'm guessing that that was actually drafted by the previous Conservative government, not by New Labour.
So,
unless it was written in a huge hurry.
New Labour did have a bit of a Stephen Miller approach. That is to say that they had, you know, their executive orders ready to go when it came to constitutional reform. The major government didn't seem to have too much of a keenness to adopt the convention domestically, whereas that was a manifesto pledge, as I recall it. I'm too young to remember, of course, but I'm pretty sure it is in there. And they were quite keen to move at pace with constitutional reform. And there was optimism around it, too, which is why it was so doable. You know, they'd won an election on a landslide of a Starmerite kind, but with popular support. And they were promising.
I can remember it. I can remember it quite clearly, the sense, because it was after 18 years of Conservative government, first Thatcher for three terms and then Major for, I think, two terms. Well, something, 1.5 terms, I think. So the media, the had painted that as a sort of nightmarish 18 years of hard right, crusty, bigoted conservatism, just completely fossilized and not in tune with the modern world, not to mention racist and sexist and homophobic and all that.
Very dry, yes.
Yeah. And so New Labour came in, and first of all, there was Kinnock in 92 who failed to win the election. And then there was John Smith who took over as leader, then he died, and that's how Tony Blair became leader. At such a young age, I think he was 40 or something. And then they won in a landslide, and it was not like Starmer last year. It was
I mean, in euphoric. Terms of scale of the majority, certainly not the way it happened splitting of their opposition.
Well, and the tone, I mean, the tone was euphoric in 1997 when they won. Loads of people, because I think they'd been told I mean, maybe it was manufactured. Maybe the British public weren't that committed to it, but certainly the media were. There's no question of that. And there was this sense that, okay, the national renewal now, they're going to do all the things that should have been done 10, 20 years ago. They're going to catch up with the modern world. And another of the things they did, of course, very early on, because it makes sense to you that they had this stuff planned, ready to go. And another one of those things was the reform of the House of Lords, which largely castrated it.
No, I tend to agree. It turned it into a stackable entity that has been stacked thereafter and stacked by protocol laid out in that period of heavy legislation and heavy regulation or creation of regulators. So you end up with, we must have a fair and even representation of all kinds of people who are on the maximally centre-right and centre-left. And that is who generally ends up in the House of Lords. This idea of not allowing anybody into public life at any point, be it in the professions, be it in the vetting processes into politics, be it into Parliament itself, and conduct in Parliament, and then in the House of Lords, almost ensured permanent centre-left governance to the point that, well, that's what we've had since. it's a very intelligent way of doing it by just making any kind of personal expression outside of that deem you unfit for public life. The House of Lords was a great loss because it was one of these things that was totally insulated from that. Because, of course, the passage of these seats, with the exception of the Lord Spiritual and the Lord Lords, was entirely hereditary. And therefore, you couldn't constrain these people into a certain mode of being. They were tied to the land and they were tied to this thing via, you know, a historic passing down of these things. And that led to different concerns. When the 1999 Life Peers Act came in, and they were all put on timer, that immediately allowed these people to be constrained by behavior, knowing that they were short for the grave, really. I mean, figuratively speaking. The House of Lords now is in such a state of being stacked by sort of figures from NGOs, fairly unlearned in many ways, centrist type political figures, that it is itching to be pointed at and say we must get rid of it. But whether that is by design also, I can't ascribe that much of a 4D chess play to the 1999 Life Peers Act, but it has happened. Because it's simply political patronage, and people can see that that is actually worse in many ways than a hereditary passing down of the seats. And then, of course, they've got rid of the law lords by creating the Supreme Court in the Constitutional Reform Act. So there's little to be said for the House of Lords, and this is a crying shame. And it's something that I think does demand a restoration, because there's wisdom in having these people who are insulated from the political day-to-day. They don't need to have their political salaries. They don't need to constrain themselves within the parameters of political discourse. And therefore, they can add a proper independent opinion collectively upon legislation.
Don't owe their appointment to anyone. So
no,
they've got no
not.
One.
They owe it to
debt.
The fact that they were the oldest son. You know, they don't have anybody to thank necessarily by action, besides, well, their own father, usually.
Yeah. And I don't think that was deliberate about ruining it so that people would want it abolished. I think it's a funny idea, but I think the idea was that we'll make it the way we want it, and the public will love that. They'll appreciate it. And what's actually happened is that the public hate it because these are the epitome that they're in a way they're even more contemptible than politicians, the MPs in the House of Commons, because at least you can say, well, they're democratically elected and that's why they're cocky and treacherous, because they want to get back in 5 years. With the Lords, they don't have that excuse. So it's in a way it's even worse. But I agree with that. What you're saying is there are these selection criteria, not just for government, but in the charity sector, in management, in the media, everywhere, education, so that only people who agree with certain precepts will ever gain a foothold in power, and then have the ability to ascend. And so that results in a very homogenous
intellectually
governing
homogenous,
class.
Both houses, anybody entering politics, by definition, entering politics requires that. So
yes,
the not being able to enter public life is the phrase, really. Like those are the sort of bottlenecks. And that, I think, is very intelligent in a way to set out a plan for future governance. Margaret Thatcher said that she, when she's asked who or what her proudest achievement is, she says Tony Blair, because she basically made him appreciate the idea of common markets and pursue this sort of Europhilic policy in, you know, as her opposition and after Major. But what Tony Blair's greatest achievement really was, making that permanent by never allowing anybody who deviates from it to enter politics. And we saw that with the aftermath of the referendum, that there really were no politicians in that particular parliament who were anything but. And they'd gotten so used to this deference upwards and this deference downwards, and that could never be shaken. And the normal feeders for politics being the professions, and in particular law, it's in 2006 that Tony Blair manages to make sure that the Bar Standards Board isn't organised by its members anymore. It's organised by a newly created state body that regulates it, which does the same thing to the people who fed into Parliament. So you stop getting lawyers in Parliament, and you also stop getting lawyers who are political, generally speaking, in an independently minded way. So it doesn't just apply to government and the vetting for political parties, while that is a big part of it. It also applies through the creation of those 93 regulators to just about every walk of life that could possibly make you significant enough to enter Parliament sort of laterally through that. So it is quite genius, and it uses legislation that predates Tony Blair too. The Public Order Act of 1986 is baked in to a lot of these selection criteria for parties. It's baked into our press regulation, interestingly, voluntarily, when it comes to IPSO, the print regulator, at clause 12 of clause 12 of that. So every major publication subscribes to this. And Ofcom, after its creation in 2003, enforces it on all broadcast media. The effect of the Public Order Act is that you cannot ever say anything potentially disparaging or other than wholly positive about basically any ethnic group at any point. And well, that sounds okay. Well, maybe we shouldn't be bigoted about people and things, but it has come to the point that in averting that potential liability, these regulators have made people unable to discuss anything to do with this at all. Perhaps the last decade has seen it flip to the point, peaking with the George Floyd event stuff in 2020. Wait, of course you shouldn't say anything other than wholly positive things about an ethnic group. But it was already there long before that, and it had caused, through risk of an aversion of potential liability, it had caused that silence on things like grooming gangs. It had caused that silence on things like really disgusting ethnic populations immigrating in. And it still remains there like a gargoyle upon most of our media, at least legacy media, as we might call it now, that prevents this discussion ever happening. So it's our public discourse can't do it. The professions can't do it. Neither of our houses of our parliament can do it. It puts us in a bit of a dilemma, but I think it's a very fixable one, and it's very fixable with very little motion, in fact.
Before we get to that, let's just outline that this is the legal infrastructure that locks us into the course that we're on, and that we have been on since at least 1997. And that is why nothing gets done that should be done. And this country is just heading towards catastrophe. So, okay, how can it be fixed?
So first of all, you just basically get rid of every section of the Public Order Act from Section 4 onwards. That is responsible for all of the speech offences that we see. It is responsible for all of the failing to report of ethnicity of criminals, largely. It is responsible for pretty much all of the vetting procedures on political parties that prevent anybody even like slightly out of milquetoast ever entering these parties. It is responsible for professions, both penalising and also, you know, disbarring and striking people off medical registers for speech in a personal capacity. And it is expanded slowly. So what you do is you repeal Section 4 onwards of the Public Order Act, ideally the whole act, and you return the first three. Oh, I've lost you there.
It's okay. I was just coughing.
Oh, good. Right. The first three parts of that act are riot, affray, and violent disorder, which people think of when they think of public disorder, right? Everything after that.
Just before you go on, it's worth saying that the Public Order Act, I believe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I believe it was brought in to help with deal with the miners' strikes in the earlier 80s, so 83, 84, and football hooligans. But this stuff about malicious group libel or what we would now call hate speech was snuck in there, which actually had nothing to do with the situations being addressed at the time. And so this was looking forwards.
It's about its applications, I would say. It was, and Section 4A particularly, was so that you could collar somebody in a football crowd and slap them with basically a fixed penalty notice. Now, that somewhat makes sense if you're policing a large crowd. But Section 4A and Section 4 and 5, and particularly Section 19, which I like to call the Connolly section, that is the offence of stirring up racial hatred. You don't have to actually do it or cause any action, but a potential observer, not a real one, could be stirred to racial hatred by what you have said. It's genuinely pre-crime, but it's a 1986 creation. All of those portions of that act are applied online frequently, and they convict upwards of 15,000 people every year. That's just Section 4 on. You only get a few people for riot because it's very difficult to make out. You only get a few people for violent disorder because it's equally more difficult to make out. But for the speech and more, were you alarmed and distressed by something, offences, which is Section 4 and 4A, or were you alarmed and distressed by a publication of something or a sign? Or was an imaginary person who doesn't even exist, could they be moved to racial hatred? Those are the bits that really need to go. Now, this covers basically all of our online speech landscape that is, we see egregious things from Southport last year in the aftermath of that unrest, people commenting on it and being convicted under these various sections, in particular Section 19, hence I call it the Connolly section of the Public Order Act. That's one thing, and it solves basically our speech landscape online to a decent degree, at least, that these public comments cannot simply offend an observer, which is the most ludicrous part. But they're also baked into lots of regulation, which leads to dismissals. It leads to turning your nose up and being squeamish at people in case that institution or employer potentially offends this act. And they're guided to do that. So removing this act solves quite a lot. The other thing, if we're going to go through how to solve our speech landscape, blast the Public Order Act completely. The other key one is the Communications Act 2003. That creates Ofcom. It also creates offences related to malicious communications of a kind that are digital. And to be perfectly honest, I think you need to be demonstrating a level of preparation or an immediate incitement of a specific kind of violence or harm to a specific person to even be imminent, basically, to even be in the realm of criminality. So those two acts remove some pretty big blocks immediately. The Conservative government under Rishi Sunak brought in the Online Safety Act, which rather than doing censorship and conviction for speech, it tries to prevent speech from happening in the first place, particularly by targeting potentially dangerous sites and restricting them and encouraging Ofcom, made in 2003, empowering it to do that, as it has with 4chan, as it has with Kiwi Farms, as it has with a variety of more helpless, smaller sites. And we're now seeing a pushback because these are frequently American individuals, almost uniformly American individuals with no legal presence in the way that they operate their sites and businesses in the United Kingdom being threatened by a regulator created in 2003 that has been empowered in 2023. So quite rightly, there's pushback there. Preston Brin has been extremely informative about quite how that's that pushback has been going and has been representing 4chan in that that dispute. He's used the term hamster bedding as a way of describing the kind of insistences that have come from Ofcom to American clients. And the general approach of Ofcom and the Online Safety Act is to prevent potentially dangerous speech ever happening by it never having been seen or never having the platforms that it would normally take place on, never having been accessible to the Englishman. So the Public Order Act deals with things that have been said. The Online Safety Act deals with things that haven't yet been said but might, and often restricts content on platforms like Twitter. You'll see after the Bondi Beach shooting, there was a large amount of posts that were unavailable due to local laws. And those were footage of the shooters. And it wasn't particularly graphic, but that is all that is required. It may, in fact, be dangerous in some way, and it can be restricted. So those three are the key ones: the Communications Act 2003, Public Order Act 1986, Online Safety Act 2023. Immediately then, the Englishman is breathing a lot easier. And it would take all of three pages worth of legislation to do that. Probably less if you wanted to make the print a little smaller.
It would be a very simple thing to do. The Online Safety Act, of course, is what we're dealing with now. A lot of people are seeing the effects of it. Ofcom became empowered. I think it took effect a few months ago.
And so they've been winding up their powers, basically. They've been booting up like a Death Star.
Yeah, exactly. And people will have seen Substack. Some of my essays are behind an age wall now. You've got to verify that you're over 18 to see
it. The Q's was the one that I saw targeted lately, where suddenly all of their stuff was age-restricted abruptly in the last four.
Well, who, sorry?
Jacques Hughes, the public.
Ah, right, yeah. I don't know if all of my essays are behind an age wall. I hope not. But the thing is, that's inevitably going to happen, because it's simpler than having to read every essay to check. They'll just say, well, he frequently puts this kind of stuff up. So, I mean, 5 of his 100 essays were like that, so we'll just do all of them automatically.
We assume they are all like this then, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Because that's going to, inevitably, that's where it's going to go, because otherwise they'll have a massive workload to get through. So it incentivizes platform providers to be very, very censorious.
Err on the side of caution. And do blanket removal of content and at least age verification. The legislator is not a sophisticated user of the internet typically. And therefore, when they say, well, it's fine to have somebody facially ID and things like this, that seems like a fairly innocuous thing. If you really want to see it, then you can see it. They don't understand that realistically that crushes reach. And when it comes to virality and indeed the way things do spread, crushing reach through inconvenience is one of the most damning things you can do. So the way it's been enforced on a variety of large platforms, all of the big five major platforms really, have been encouraged to restrict content and err on the side of caution. So it's almost like a pre-crime measure that the Public Order Act would otherwise step in on if you were posting something here, potentially. Instead of doing that approach, just blanket remove the thing out of the public eye. It can therefore never be a political or electoral problem.
Yeah. I mean, it's just bad. It's infantilizing of the public, of a population. And I don't... it's infuriating. It's embarrassing. you know, for Americans to see this stuff, it embarrasses me because I think what must they think of, you know,
a global laughingstock, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. However, similar stuff is apparently happening. It's happened in Australia. It's happening in the EU, the Digital Services Act, I think. And then there's one in America being cooked up right now. So no one actually has much ground to feel smug about this. It just happens that Britain was first.
Somebody called it the long night. Will be the consequence of when the internet is no longer capable of calling itself a place where discourse can happen. No longer can social media call itself social. Even the group chat, the last bastion of genuine human interaction done privately, will be observable. And all of those things will have punitive consequences for you. At that point, people will self-censor to the extent that the long night will happen where there is no longer any dissent. And if that convergent pattern happens, then it'll be very difficult to wriggle out of, certainly digitally, and perhaps permanent. I saw an essay, I forget the name of the chap actually, but he described it as the long night, and I thought that was an interesting way of giving a visual metaphor to this, where, yes, it'd be permanent blackness if they all do converge on the sense of regulating for safety reasons. Interesting point on the Online Safety Act. It actually prevents child victims of rape from whistleblowing. Because going to a whistleblowing site for the purposes of something like that would be age restricted. I found this when writing a policy for a whistleblowing site and discovered that essentially Online Safety Act compliance would require there are no children on it.
Anyway, right, right.
The considered consequences. Yeah.
And of course, there's no point going to the police because they're politicized as well. So, what's a child supposed to do? This is just terrible. But again, it's all off a piece with the mentality of New Labour, and this is why people say we seem to be eternally living under New Labour, and they haven't been in power for, what, 15 years now, and yet they still, this is the tenor under which we live. So moving on from abolishing those three acts, what else would you, I wanted to ask you in particular, because there was one thing that, well, actually you go first. What else would you abolish?
Ask away. I think these things are all interconnected in an infuriating way. Because Tony Blair was quite forward-thinking in many of these realms where he's made his type of government permanent. That is why people are still questioning why they're living under New Labour. We're living under New Labour now, but they're stewarding the same project. Anyway, sorry, what was your question about what comes next after setting up the ability to breathe easily and speak freely?
Well, I remember an article on the Restorationist website that mentioned a more proper kind of devolution where even England is divided with Cornwall having its own parliament and so forth. And that interested me because instinctively I support this kind of thing. I think that Scotland probably should have its own regional, its own governance and its own identity. Wales, yes. I don't like this idea that, I mean, it was created it's for the empire. Britain was for the empire. It was for a moment in time. I think it's, even though there's an awful lot of commonality between these countries, I think it probably is right that they split apart from Britain, that Britain dissolves in a way, and that they rule themselves and govern themselves. So that makes sense to me. Cornwall, I've been to Cornwall once, admittedly only once, but even then I remember feeling this is distinctly different from the rest of England. There's something different about Cornwall. I didn't go into it. And then Yorkshire. I mean, you could obviously divide it down insanely to every town, you know, but I'm not going to do that. I just think it makes sense that places become more self-governing and self-sufficient, ideally, sort of anti-globalistic process. And so that appeals to me. However, what we've seen with devolution is the opposite, where everywhere just becomes more globalistic, if that's quite the right word. And that's obviously the wrong way to go about it. So I was interested in that article on the Restorationist about a better way to devolve and really put to bed the idea of Great Britain, at least as a state entity.
So Britain, as you say rightly, is only an identity that emerges quite in terms of its usage in language. It only emerges really after the war. It emerges after we start giving up and ceding imperial territories. Before that, the most common word to describe this landmass, particularly excluding Ireland, is England. But in the First World War and at the height of empire, the late 19th century, Englishman is almost universal, unless you really present yourself as a Scotsman. And the concept of Britain as a collection is not only post-war, but it's post-Irish independence, that we start using this unofficial documents in a proper way. The United Kingdom only comes about, I would say, as COPE, after Northern Ireland separating off. And it's first used then with a capital U and a capital K. Bit of an aside there, but I do think this modern concept of Britain in terminology and in actual usage is pretty recent. Thinking to that article, however, when we're talking about a Britannic parliament that would allow for devolution and in fact allow for the devolved parliaments to continue their existence, the proposal there was that they would continue their existence as a form of devolved upper house that would have veto on specific issues and would therefore be able to, it would prevent this sort of idea of rug pulling devolution. I'm not entirely sure I still agree with this position, and I do think that that article that discussed it was regarded as a bit loopy, given it was planning also to move Parliament, turn Parliament as it is today, into a ceremonial building and then move it to somewhere geocentric to Northern Ireland, Scotland, Wales and England around Derby. Of course, this would appeal to the kind of people who are more of a, let's say, the kind of tech bro who wants to set up an island nation or buy portions of Greenland might enjoy the idea of building a new parliament in Derby or in a field somewhere 30 miles north of Derby because of its unique position between the devolved nations. But I'm a little more sceptical to it. I think it was more of a boat-pushing idea. Using the devolved parliaments as upper houses in a reconstituted parliament is not a bad idea, but I don't fully subscribe to this idea as a solution to all things. I am more inclined towards local governance, and when you do look at somewhere like Cornwall, and the Cornish really do fiercely feel that there is an ethnic Cornish identity, which, you know, it bears fruit in the sort of the fossil record there, that they are slightly different. They are more Celtic. It is more preserved than the Anglo-Saxon invasion. It is one of those holdouts in that way. So it's not misplaced. They also have a very nice flag. How to deal with that, I think, would be to stop having so much ceremonial local government that is purely ceremonial, in my view, and start having a slightly more unchained parliament that perhaps requires some reconstituting. But I'm going to give that some thought as to how that might look in a bill. I don't think that's one of the essential things for solving the immediate problems. I think there's a speech, sort of state scale, when it comes to regulation of professions and, in fact, government itself. Demographics and also how you deal with the process of acquisition of citizenship and how you define what a citizen is, and also how you sort of square the circle of the 1948 British Nationality Act, the 1981 British Nationality Act, and then, as I discussed before, the Human Rights Act making this sort of de facto jus soli citizenship, where you can't remove people, so they just by default become citizens after 5 years, after a test. I think that's a really big one, and that's one where a lot of that injustice is felt. I think when it comes to devolution, a lot of people would have probably been in the era of modern mass immigration, would have felt more secure in themselves if you're allowed to say you were Scottish with legal basis to that. There isn't one. There is no legal distinction between me as an Englishman or you as a Scotsman. And there is no legal distinction between a Welshman and a Northern Irishman either. We are all just as British as each other, and just as British as somebody who has waited 5 years after arriving on a small boat and acquired citizenship after acquiring indefinite leave to remain by doing a test and passing a language proficiency test, be that either by yourself or conducted fraudulently by a friend. There is a distinct injustice felt there, and I think legally recognising the ethnic groups that make up the devolved nations, and indeed perhaps even more granularity than that, would be a good step, given that, as trends are currently, we are likely to be a minority in births by 2030 and a minority in schools by 2035. And that's based on some work by a friend of mine, Charlie Cole, who has done some very good work with ONS data, and really off the cuff, as soon as it's published, any data about England and Wales ethnicities and births, he's been right on there and has published a variety of work on that. Those dates, though, are a lot closer to home than the dates that were being quoted by, say, Stephen Edgington in his interview with Richard Tice, where he said, I think about 2063 will be a minority. White British people will be a minority, was quoted to him. Those are very old estimates from, I believe, a study in 2011. So I'm rambling a bit now, but
Richard Tice will still be alive in 2035.
He definitely will. And he will be old enough to, he will be perfectly cognizant enough to understand what is happening at that point as well. And perhaps if he was to visit a school whilst his party is in government, in that first parliament of the Reform government, and he has to visit a school as the education minister, he will see that the white British population have become a minority in schools by then. But until that point, I think people aren't quite grasping the rapidity of that problem. And without recognizing the constituent people of these islands in law in some fashion, there will never be any distinction of any kind there, and we will in fact cease to exist. This is one of these anathema talking points that you can't say but is imminent, and within, by the next parliament, that will already be a minority in terms of births on current trends within the first year of a Reform government, presuming that it will be 2029 that we hold an election and that Reform wins.
Yeah. I mean, at the start of the next decade, is another way to put it. At the start of the next decade, we will be a minority of the births in our own country, in our own ancestral homeland. I mean, that's very sobering. Of course, it relies on your Charlie Cole's statistics being accurate. But the thing is, even if they're not accurate, well, then it's 10 years later or 5 years later. I mean, whenever it happens, Richard Tice is likely to still be alive, and you and I are likely to still be alive. Everyone listening to this will probably still be alive when this happens. So it quibbling about the year is just one of those tedious things that you can hardly believe people are doing with a subject so serious, and yet they do, and waste so much time driveling about the what's the sample size, what's the prediction model, and all. You just have to look at any street in any city. You can see it. You can see the reality. And if you can't, then there's something wrong with you. It's obvious. It's obvious this is happening.
Mr. Cole's predictions are based on the latest ONS publications from this year. And if he is wrong, then the ONS is wrong. And if the ONS is wrong, then our eyes and ears cannot be also wrong when that sort of thing is identifiable in a widespread way, but is you can't talk about it in many circles. And many people won't publish things that recognize this. So it's good to see that that is being, it's an Overton window opening exercise there that is slow, maybe too slow, because of the reasons I've described with the Public Order Act's regulation of a variety of all of our broadcasters and pretty much every big print media outlet. It could be faster, but I think we might just get there. And this year has been particularly indicative in seeing more discussion about that in outlets that you wouldn't expect.
Yes. Yeah. Well, there's been a lot of talk about civil war with David Betts. I'm sure you're aware of that. But I think also aside from that, I mean, and that sort of sits atop a growing awareness of just the reality of ethnic groups, that ethnicity is not something that you can just wish away or legislate away or acculturate away. It persists through generations. It's a reality. And I think for a long, long time, the broad public believed otherwise and were desperate to believe otherwise. But I think in recent times, in the last few couple of years, the scales have fallen from their eyes, and they're increasingly starting to realize that this is the truth, and it's not going to go away, and your kids are going to have to deal with it, and your grandkids are going to have to deal with it. So it's interesting to see this, because in the world of New Labour in the 2000s, you won't remember this, but I do. The 2000s was very much a sort of blank decade, culturally and politically. There were no real issues. It started in 2008 with, like, between 2001 when 9/11 happened. You'd think that would spur a lot of thought, but it didn't for some reason. It was just, you know, skepticism about the US government and the military industrial complex, whatever, but it was very much a sort of bland, generic suspicion of government power. It wasn't specific. And my point is that world of New Labour was a world of luxury where people didn't really think about things and didn't really take things seriously, because we had comfort and prosperity and a sense that those would just continue. And then 2008 kind of ended that. The 2010s then went hyper-political with wokery. And then COVID at the start of the 2020s. And now we're in this... And then this... It made wokery even worse for a few years. That was the peak of it. And then we're now in this new era where we're now facing the reality of after all of that, first obliviousness and then insane leftism. What we're left with is we're about to become a minority. And with the Boris wave as well, that's been made even more obvious. It's been made even more stark. We can see it already starting, even in villages and towns. So I think there's a change of national consciousness is happening. That's why Reform are so popular, despite all their flaws, and look like they're going to win the next election, whenever it is. And I don't want to make this a discussion about Reform, but at least the party. I wonder only whether Reform will be able to placate the British public, or are they too milquetoast to do that? Because I think by that time, I mean, already, things are really hot. What on earth are they going to be like in 4 years' time when Reform get in? So I wonder what the public will be clamoring for by that point. So is there anything else you would like to say about reforming Britain healing these problems on a legal basis? Because let's just emphasize one more time, you can say culture is downstream from this and that, and law is downstream from this and that, but a lot of this does rest on law. I mean, it's law that makes me have to think carefully about every sentence I speak, especially on Millennial, every sentence I write on Substack. It's law that paralyzes us, but it's also law that could free us. So is there anything else you'd like to say about that?
So the speech stuff is fairly simple to unpick, I think, surprisingly so, and the chilling effect that uncertainty around our speech is immense, like you've just described, and actually you don't really know where you stand most of the time. I think reform understands this. I'm optimistic that they have been informed by people who have been banging the drum about that specific issue and understand how it can in fact be pulled back with simplicity. With the scale of the state, which is regulators that then enact that stuff and would still have the muscle memory without the Public Order Act, for example, whether they know that they need to destroy quite a lot of this quangocracy that was created in the Blair era. We're talking like 400 state bodies that were created in the last 30 years. I only need to look to the last 5 years to find two prime ministers who have been ousted by these bodies, Liz Truss by the OBR and Boris Johnson functionally by Sage, for breaching the what he had deferred to them during the lockdown period that he allowed to happen and was justified under the CHR, I might add. Article 2, the right to life, was used to justify the suspension of all other liberties. But those are two prime ministers in the last 5 years who have been ousted by permanent quangos, or as they call themselves, arm's length bodies. I think the big thing that reform is going to run into is being able to quickly enough do a bit of a sort of a storm through of all of these various and identifying what created them and presenting primary legislation and secondary legislation to dispose of them before they are ousted by bodies like the OBR, which of course will be up in arms by anything particularly radical economically. They've already attempted to embarrass and perhaps even attempt to oust the Chancellor in a Labour government by leaking her entire budget moments before she was about to announce it. So if they're doing that to the manor born inheritors of the Blairite state, God only knows what would be the likely outcome of a reform government attempting to do anything without having a concrete plan to repeal and dispose of a variety of these permanent bodies. So speech is one thing that I think is fairly easy to fix. Being bold enough to dispose of a lot of this permanent state, deep state, whatever you want to call it, it exists, and it exists in good number, and it's a recent creation. Disposing of that via legislation is the other thing. And you do need to be ready to go, like Stephen Miller was advising the Trump 2 regime in bashing out executive orders, all ready to go on day one, first 100 days mindset. I think that's going to be the big problem for reform in the first 100 days. For the immigration stuff, which is really their lifeblood, I don't want to talk about reform too much, but this is the lifeblood key issue now in British politics. If you cannot placate the domestic population in a way that they feel that they have been restored to a position that they were in before the harm was done and before their identity was called into question by the presence of a lot of other people, the Boris wave, as you mentioned, the ease with which indefinite leave to remain can be acquired. If that is not addressed, then that immigration issue and sense of a loss of nationhood and identity will only deepen. That's going to be not terribly difficult to do legislatively, and I drafted a bill that would do that and simplifies the last century of immigration law into simple categories. It undoes what we accidentally did with the creation of Commonwealth citizens and Commonwealth voting in 1948, unbakes some of those injustices that were baked in in 1981. The key thing is, it's not terribly difficult if one man can basically do it with some assistance, but it's an uphill political battle, because everyone will say it's a slippery slope. Everyone will say, by defining the Englishman, the Scotsman, the Irishman, and the Welshman in law, and giving him status in law, will be the beginning of a two-tiered society in the inverse direction. But I don't think anyone disagrees that we have a asymmetric, in terms of application of law, society in the present. I therefore don't think it's radical or a slippery slope. I think if they can be brave enough and they can survive the Quangocracy, then that is the thing that will provide them a legacy, if they can get it done. And leaving the ECHR may require its own entire act, to be quite honest, or bill before it is an act, just to free up the wiggle room for any administration to do what it needs to in other realms without being subject to lawfare in the form of judicial reviews based on ECHR rights. But speech, state scale, and the Quangocracy, and basically a reset of nationality and citizenship acquisition. I call my draft bill the British Indigeneity and Citizenship Act, BINCA for short. So it can be done. And those solutions, you know, are out there. I think they need some refinement, and I'm going to publish a new version of that, informed by the decisions of our immigration tribunals. The upper tribunals' decisions are all readily available. And I've basically formed an algorithm based on the outcome decisions in that to operate at a much more efficient pace, and taking into account a lot more things that people generally want to deport people for. Criminality, complete freeloadership, having absolutely no ties here. And it would do those things in lieu of the ECHR, which only positively presumes, like, okay, so you've got this, you know somebody here, and so you have a private life or a family life, or you've had a child out of wedlock, you have a family life, we can't deport you. It should work in the inverse way. It's like, do you have these things in a meaningful way? You turn it into an algorithm, and if not, then you are reviewable.
Well, and also, if you have those a family life, relatives, then can we deport them as well along with you?
I subscribe to the Tim Homan position, which you know, Trump's deportations are, which is, yes, of course, families should be kept together.
Yeah, exactly. And to be honest, that's true. I mean, I don't want to split up families. And
it would be absurd to leave children behind in the hopes that you're passing them into a better life.
Yeah.
It's very odd.
Yeah. No one wants to do that. It's monstrous. Obviously, whole families should be deported. All right. So we'll get to some super chats now. But before we do that, I just want to emphasize what you're doing is drafting legislation that could actually be used. I want to make sure that people understand what you're doing with what you did with the restorationist and what you're now doing with your new project, which is linked below, I'm pretty sure. It is a very ambitious thing, but it's also very laudable. And this is why I wanted to have you on Millennial, because I always say I want to have people who are actually doing things. The more practical and real world, the better. And I think this is terrific. I think this is great work. So I commend you, and I hope that other people can see the not just the worthiness of it, but the worthwhileness of it. I think this is crucial stuff, because even if your exact legislation isn't used, it can form the basis for some of that, a starting point for a national government to do it.
My whole thing with it is that it was with the restorationist stuff, we did get some drafts out, and I want to get some better drafts out, and it's to be unpretentious about this thing that here's a starting point. You know, this is what is possible in terms of just legislative construction. This can be tailored to any party's whims, and should or could be. And these are the things that I identify as being key in setting us back on the right course, stabilizing the nation in a way that doesn't feel like we're in complete disarray and we have this headache constantly of like, oh, there's so many issues. I remember being in a Twitter space at one point, and there was an introduction that dealt with a bunch of news articles and things that have been happening, you know, the usual kind of mass murders and rapes and people going to prison for tweets and things. And every single one of them all came back to the Public Order Act. So when I was asked the question, I said, well, those are all easily solvable. Just get rid of that. The fact that these things are less known than, you know, even in the legal profession, that they're strangely unknown and not too difficult to turn into draft legislation is baffling. And when you get political parties basically just dealing in bullet points rather than in draft bills, and bills are, you know, the language of Parliament, which is our sovereign, and it has supremacy to the point it can legislate about the orbit that we take around the sun if it wishes. Whether it's enforceable is another matter. You have to do these things in bills, otherwise you are simply just a talking shop. So it's disconcerting that it's all manifestos and manifestos and manifestos. And I wanted to demonstrate that you can be any Tom, Dick and Harry, really, and have some legal nous and put together some solutions that actually aren't as complex as they may look, and unpick these issues that have a lot of, you know, one bill can have its finger in a dozen pies and no one will ever talk about it in the press. So that was the purpose of it. And I think it'll take probably about five bills to stabilize the ship of state, to prevent it from going completely off the waterfall. Some of that is reversing the clock and undoing things. Some of that is attempting to be inventive in how things will proceed from there. We do have to go back a little way before we can proceed in good faith, is my view. And I think I came upon the term restorationism through David Starkey, and who had been a mentor of mine and has always been, you know, very active in talking about these issues, more so in recent years. But that term itself, to restore something, restore Britain, restorationism, all these things, presume a sort of starry-eyed backwards-looking thing. I see it more as going back to a safe state on a server that you've buggered up all the code and now you need to go back to something that works and then proceed with force from there, rather than simply muddling into more of what we have been seeing for the passing various decades, but acutely in the last 5 years. You have to go back before you can go forwards.
Yeah, you have to undo some of the retarding legislation before you can proceed to build a better country. I take the point. Okay, we'll get to some super chats then. And here we go. In a TIN, I'm not going to read out that question for reasons I'm sure you can understand. I'll just put the general point to Michael. What do you think of... and I don't know what your religious views are, your faith, but this person is saying that Christianity is a weakness. Now, again, it kind of annoys me when people post things like this, because it's obviously got nothing to do with the stream and the conversation that we've been having. But nonetheless, he's put it to you, so yeah. I'm
reading it out. I think in this country, Christianity has become largely a social institution in the last century. And I actually responded to somebody who was asking about, you know, are you a Christian, Michael? What is your particular faith? Or, you know, do you have a particular faith? I always say that I'm an Englishman first and a Christian second. But, you know, I'm very favorable to people like Tom Rousell's work, who I put in the new website. He did an article, What is an Englishman? And his points on the idea of religion in Britain being an entirely social institution for a century, I think are pretty on point there. Those are, you know, it's been a coffee morning organizing thing for a long time. We probably shouldn't have had a reformation in 1534, and even Henry VIII wasn't too happy about it, died a Catholic. But the the missionary sentiment of trying to Christianize the Englishman, it required those people attempting to convert the Englishman to tailor it to him by suggesting it was a warrior religion, that Christ was somebody who was actually compatible with the pantheon at times, that was said. And it had to be sold as something that was sort of violent and conquering and suited the temperament of the Anglo-Saxon, who, generally speaking, wants to, as his antidote to evil, hang people and things of that variety. So it had to tone itself up in its sort of its viciousness of justice. And those are the bits that I think still persist when we say we're a Christian country. It's those things that have been baked into our judicial system that are actually quite Anglo-Saxon. And then we've lost all that sort of conqueror religion element in the last century slowly, and then all at once, to quote a famous author, slowly and then suddenly all at once. We ended up with a Church of England, for example, that is so open to all things, it has ceased to even exist as an institution functionally. It doesn't just organise coffee mornings. It organises coffee mornings for anyone who isn't an Anglo-Saxon, for that matter, if at all possible, and acts as a sort of political apparatchik for that kind of ideology. The current Archbishop of Canterbury being a good example. So while I consider myself an Englishman first and a Christian second, there's plenty to be said about the fact that these institutions are so rotten and have been for so long that reviving them is a sort of LARPerish endeavour. And therefore, that's why I phrase it as such. And people who suggest that we bring a sort of Christian ethos into politics in Britain, I think they're absolutely barking. And this is about as un-English as you could possibly get. It's a highly American import. Even plastering Christianity onto the Englishman was a matter of trying to trick him into thinking it was a suit of armour. And at various points, those are the sort of high points of Christendom, the Crusades, for example. This is exactly where you can kind of, for Christendom, be an Englishman at last in your essence and in that kind of human need to be quite violent, actually. So that's my answer, a bit long-winded. And I'm an Englishman first and a Christian second, but I am speaking on millennial, so I feel like I may be in the right place.
Not at all. I'm very ambidextrous about this. I just don't think it's worth falling out about. I don't think we can afford to. I mean, for heaven's sake, we're going to be, as we said earlier, a minority in our own country in a very short time. Can we really afford to fall out about paganism versus Christianity? I absolutely don't think so.
Which flavour of minority religion do we want to be?
Exactly. We've just got to put these squabbles aside. And if you can't do that, then just get out of the room, basically. You're just in the way of people who are prepared to be more reasonable.
It's not a hill I would die on, personally, but
yeah, exactly.
I can see why people feel strongly about it.
Of course, I can as well. I just think now's not the time. All right, Dardy said, I know Canada and Ireland are basically trying to pass direct copies of the UK Digital Online Safety Act. Australia just passed an even more egregious bill last week that if you're under 16, you cannot be on social media via age restrictions. You know, I'm in two minds about that because I don't think under 16s should be on social media because it must be absolutely toxic for them. It's bad enough for adults, let alone when you're 14 and insecure and wanting to fit in and wanting to impress your friends and so on. And very vulnerable to bullying. And I'm sure a mountain of that stuff goes on every day. So in a way, I'm sympathetic to this thing about keeping youngsters off social media until they're, 18 ideally. But I'd like it to be done in a way that doesn't inconvenience everyone else. And I bet it could be as well. I bet there's some way we could do it. But anyway, do you have anything to say about that? Australia and Ireland and so?
So I ended up growing up with social media being a younger sibling, almost. You know, it was sort of a younger sibling to me, and it was this thing that was growing up at the same time as me. And now it is fully grown, and I think it has taken on the role of sort of an abusive parent to somebody who is coming into the world at age, you know, that you're well into the age that you would be looking at the internet by 16. And therefore, this thing is so fully formed, so highly well-oiled and highly predatory, I would say, in the way that it funnels content to you. It means you know no goodwill. And you know, there is an argument to be made for, well, these people shouldn't be on it because the thing has changed fundamentally. We can't all grow up with it like it's a sibling. The time has passed, and what do you do with it now? Well, I think a bit like deporting entire families is that entire families should be able to enforce the idea that you don't spend your entire life on social media. Whether families are entirely capable of doing that, insofar as young people seem to be living in this ersatz version of community and therefore are left out, I think the helplessness of parents has led to demanding solutions from the state. But this isn't anything new. This is sort of Christian mothers in the 2000s saying that Grand Theft Auto is evil. And that is the sort of level of insight to the internet that is being drawn upon by legislators to say we should outlaw it. I don't see it as a 4D chess move to completely restrict everything, but I do see that as the net effect of inconveniencing reach, like with the Bondi Beach thing, saying you need to scan your face and show your ID to see a video of a man disarming a gunman next to a palm tree, which many of us saw, but many of us won't have on the day because it was age restricted. And you would have had to identify yourself to show that you were actually an adult. I don't think there was anything graphic in that. I don't think that there was anything particularly like inspiring of a young person to go and become a gunman in that. But because people have this sort of highly pearl-clutching view of the internet, and legislators do too, we always come back to it. And rather than encouraging a sort of more hands-on form of parenting or questioning why it is, in fact, that people are retreating to these ersatz communities, largely sort of a general loss of community, a loss of nationhood and sense of identity, and mass immigration means that people aren't sort of free to go about their business in a way that they can form genuine communities, so they retreat online. Those are sort of the more systemic, for lack of a better word, problems that lead to this fear of the internet. But these are not sophisticated internet users legislating on it. It reminds me of Lucy Powell, now leader of the House of Commons, but when she was in opposition in 2018, said that in a private members bill, in fact, that we should ban all private Facebook group chats and all private Facebook groups, which, you know, may sound mad because it didn't happen. But really what she meant was there should be no private realm on the internet where people can transact ideas. And the sort go on, sorry.
It's very, very much the Nurse Ratched schoolmarm kind of mentality, which, yeah, it's unfortunate that people like that are in power.
But I always come back to this. It's people who do not have a sophisticated understanding of the internet, who are prosecuting people for risque comments. They are suggesting widespread suspension of websites and suspension of entire population groups from websites. Age is the only one. Imagine if they tried to suggest that women couldn't go on the internet, but age seems to be the one that they're fixated on. So all of this comes from people who are not sophisticated internet users, and that is a huge part of our problem. And that will be the case across legislators and legislatures across the Anglosphere, which is what we've seen with Australia, who've been thinking about things like this for quite a while. And I wasn't actually aware of the Ireland stuff, but I'll have to look into that.
All right. Ireland and Canada. Okay, Pleb Lordy Is there scope for constitutional or cultural clubs to inform the public? I worry these issues are hard to understand and articulate. Could we rebuild our romantic attachment to our constitutional folkways?
That's a good question. It's been an idea I've been toying around for a while, that this idea isn't entirely original because, for example, Reform was saying we should get Reform clubs and buy all the Conservative clubs that have nice buildings. And I thought, no, actually, we should start getting nasty telephone sort of exchanges and car parks and refacing them in perpendicular Gothic and turning them into private members clubs for this exact purpose in everything from Peterborough to Keighley. And at some point we will be able to educate each other in the actual remainders of our constitution in those kinds of places. I'm partly joking, but people articulating what is left of our constitution as we think of it is really important. Like Magna Carta, for example, there's only three clauses left. There's only three clauses that are still in force, and most of them are meaningless. They're functionally, one secures the independence of the Church of England, basically, or at least that's how it's treated. And they've just done away with jury trial functionally anyway, but without a mandate and all that, on the basis of Lord Leveson's report on whether it's necessary or not. So these things that we think of as parts of our constitution, like the Bill of Rights and the Magna Carta, there's scant little of it left. Parliamentary privilege is one of those things from the Bill of Rights, where it's like you can say anything in Parliament. Absolutely not. It's been stripped and stripped away. Even as a parliamentarian, you don't have true freedom of speech. Like, for example, discussing the Ruta Cabana case was, you know, the standard subjudice rule, as they call it. You can't discuss anything that is in any way a live investigation or hasn't been adjudicated on, even if they're of crucial importance. And much more than that, too. Like, you have to declare all your interests and avoid speaking about them, and you can be penalised for it. And, of course, there's so many points of order. And then there's an MP's code of conduct that was standardised in the Major era and built upon by Blair. So actually understanding how little of our constitution remains and which the operative things are, like I keep coming back to the Public Order Act, but these are the ones people interface with when the police knock on your door. And we don't have five amendments that we can rattle off by heart and say, no, you know, I'm pleading the fifth, I'm exercising my right to silence. We don't even have a right to silence. Adverse inference can be drawn against you. So I'm rambling a bit, but the question was, can we sort of get back to our sort of folk constitutional roots and this sort of idea of negative liberty, as you drew upon earlier, where you said that an Englishman's right is to do whatever he pleases until he's told not to. There's so many things that tell you not to that we could probably start by figuring out which the most operative things are there. And I'm always aiming my sights at the Public Order Act with that one. But good to start with what's the inconveniencing legislation before you start trying to prevent it ever happening again in statute.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Dumer Tears says, could you talk about the means of and procedures for petitioning, prosecuting, somethinging the head of state, still the possessor of the courts, armed forces, etc., for treason or criminal conspiracy or negligence in or vicarious liability in the harm done to his subjects? So basically prosecuting the head of state for indirectly or directly harming his subjects.
So,
is there any way to do that?
The interesting thing with a monarch as the head of the armed forces and also able to prorogue parliament, who has governments form at his request after an advisory type of election, and this arrangement is there's a lot of weird stuff in it, actually. And in 2019, we had a judicial review on whether Boris Johnson could use the Queen's powers to prorogue and dismiss Parliament was, in fact, a power available to him. The same thing with the royal prerogative in 2017, I believe, was the Miller No. 1 case, as to whether Theresa May even had the ability to invoke Article 50 and leave the European Union without without further consent, whether she could do that without Parliament's consent as well. When it comes to prosecuting the King, you have a few problems, because, of course, most prosecutions rely on the King standing in as prosecutor. The Treason Act of 1351 could be used for some interesting things, and I'm open to that. But the monarchy at present has insulated itself through legislation from so many forms of civil and criminal action that actually deposing the king would require some kind of genuine abdication type situation rather than pursuing a prosecution. Then you could do so with whatever arrangement you see fit to be the prosecutor. But presently it is the crown. And of course, it would be very awkward with a sitting monarch to have likely King's Counsel representing both the prosecution and the defence. But I think a lot of these things are vaguely romantic. And one of the most interesting romantic ones was that the Crown Oath, which was codified around the time of the Bill of Rights, requires that the monarch actually serves his people as the King of England. And therefore, any immigration legislation which did not do that would be invalid. It would be void, actually. It wouldn't necessarily be done properly when he gives, when any monarch gives royal assent. It wouldn't be done in line with the oath of the monarch, who is the person who gives power to acts of parliament. But a lot of these things sound great. However, realistically, you're going to have to force some kind of political settlement on a monarch if you're going to start approaching even prosecuting them. There's so many carve-outs in statute to make them blameless or just prevent action at all.
I think fundamentally we've come to see the monarch as not a serious political player at all. It's supposed to be apolitical, and therefore why would it even get to that point where you would want to punish them for their for anything other than not being a good enough ornament?
And I think that's what people have started to criticize the monarchy of after the death of Elizabeth II, is that not a good enough ornament is perhaps the view of people who are, let's say, Diana stands and simps, for lack of better terminology. These people are critical of Charles innately. And then you've got people who, just more recently, based on Charles's actions and perhaps the modernization of the royal family after Diana's death, have been critical of the fact that the monarchy has become highly charitable in its appearances, has become very over-concerned with the Commonwealth rather than its duties to the actual devolved nations and primarily where the crown originates, which is the king or queen of England. Seems to be a very distant secondary or tertiary consideration. So you get people who just don't like Charles for personal reasons, and then you get people who don't like Charles for not being a good enough ornament domestically. And this seems to have really diminished trust in the monarchy. That doesn't make it more likely that we're going to be able to take him to court, though. In fact, it's very difficult to do so. And we are talking civil war realm stuff there. Maybe somebody's trying to bait me into seditious libel.
No seditious libel on millennial. I think you're right. It's interesting how this has changed, because Elizabeth II, up until her death, I think everything changed. And it's only, two or three years ago now, but it feels different. All throughout her life, even with the Diana crisis and all that, certainly for the last the 20 years after that, I think there was a lot of affection for her, actually. And I think that was mainly simply because she was a continuity. She represented a continuity over 70 years of, I think it was 70 years that she was on the throne. And so it was a link to the past. I mean, she went back a long, long way. God knows how many prime ministers and governments, and she outlasted all of that, and all the decades and the cultural movements and the demographic change, and it was always her. It was always her there. And so I think there was a lot of affection just for that reason alone. Sorry, go on.
And she also has the rare claim, despite being sort of almost like a monarchical paperweight on the institution of the monarchy, I like to credit her with one thing in particular, which she gave a name to the bell tower of the Palace of Westminster, which was previously just colloquially called Big Ben after the bell. I'm being a pedant here whenever anyone says, look, Big Ben. I'm like, yeah, well, it's called Queen Elizabeth II Tower now, as of 2011. But prior to that, it didn't have a name. There was no name. It was just the bell tower in this sort of Italianate Gothic meld style. But that's her greatest enduring legacy, I think, is giving a name to perhaps our most parliamentary and also internationally recognisable landmark.
Mm. Yeah, nobody seems to know that. No one knows that. They think that Big Ben is the name of the actual structure. It's actually the name of the bells inside it. It's one of those things. So I think there was a lot of affection for her. And part of that did rely on her being apolitical, even though that annoyed everyone at the same time, because you want her to intervene on things. You want the monarch to be... actually political. It's a sort of paradox, really. People want a democracy, but since we've got a monarch, they want the monarch to be intervening on things, and because we've seen how badly things have gone, so you think, well, why didn't she ever do anything? Anyway, so it relied on her being apolitical because she never got her hands dirty. But what's happened now is the worst of both worlds, where her successor is more political, but in the other direction, where he's this globalist, this mad, he's going on about climate change and mass immigration, protector of the faiths, plural, etc., all of the stuff. And, you know, Charles was known for this a long time ago. There's actually a Blackadder charity special, I think from 1988, and it parodies him even then. It's actually Stephen Fry who plays him, and it parodies him as this sort of wet liberal kook.
And so fruitarianism that I think tipped a lot of people off.
one of many things that did. And I don't know when that started, when he got this reputation, but it was definitely there by the late 80s. And then ever since then, people have been sort of dreading him ascending to the throne. And now it's happened, and he's behaving exactly as we predicted. But the thing is, and this is a whole other topic about the monarchy, but the thing is, once he dies, I don't know what's going to happen. In terms of the constitution, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if he is the last monarch. I don't think he will be, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Well, I've always regarded myself as a monarchist for the sake of it being a form of having a head of state that doesn't attempt to be like you. It doesn't say I'm wearing a suit just like you. You can wear a suit. You can be the monarch. It says absolutely not. You can never be the monarch. And therefore, it has a distance that instills a bit of awe. That has always instilled a bit of awe, I think. Anybody who swears an oath to defend the faith, singular, as it was given by the Pope in 1521 when Henry VIII was given the title, and also swears an oath to his or her people, but you can never be it, has this sort of star factor that no head of state generally can. And it's amazing we preserved that into modernity in this uninterrupted, with a brief interregnum. But save for that, uninterrupted for as long as we have, is impressive. And it would be a terrible shame for it to be wasted based on a man who essentially seemed more concerned with the Commonwealth than the role of being the monarch. And that's the perception. I was quite optimistic about at least Charles's views on architecture, calling things monstrous carbuncles, as you should when you see a modernist extension built upon a Georgian or a Victorian building, where some, you know, Richard Rogers is trying to make a name for his firm by putting a large glass pyramid on top of something. Calling that out and having a monarch do it is actually quite good. But that's all seemed to vanish into thin air. I think if he was to be passed up for William, which was discussed, it seems, and is a possibility, that may well re-embolden something more like the 71-72% favorability of the monarchy that we saw under Elizabeth. I don't know what it is now, but I highly doubt it's that. That was about a decade or so ago, that it was about, you know, 70% of the population were in favor of the monarchy, which is astonishing in a modern democracy of this kind. I don't even know if it's been necessarily polled in a wide enough sample size to get a gauge for that lately. I think it was Paxman's book that cited those figures on the monarchy. I don't think it'll dry up, though. I do think there's something desirable about it, to the extent that even after quite a sophisticated interregnum period under Cromwell, aspects of which were used by the founding fathers in the political settlement of our former colony. Despite that, we still had a craving for this thing, and I think we will again. It's just not always the man, it's the institution that speaks louder.
Yeah. Dimmer continues, not trying to bait you, many believe that Elizabeth II plainly broke her coronation oath by ceding authority to the European Union. Assuming this to be correct, is there no means of redress in this either?
Well, I suppose that is also true, given that supremacy was given. And means of redress now that... I'm not sure how one would seek redress against the late Elizabeth II for that, but I accept the point that essentially it was ceding at least the relationship between Parliament that follows the Civil War and that arrangement to allow for supremacy on the continent. But I'm surprised there wasn't more of a constitutional crisis surrounding that. And there were test cases about it that are important constitutional law cases around the adoption of the European Common Market after the 72 referendum. But there wasn't necessarily an equivalent of the prorogation case as to whether this was even possible and whether it was the monarch's responsibility to ensure the oath was observed by Parliament. That's an interesting question, actually, because parliamentary supremacy does allow for basically anything, like we're seeing with legislating on the Online Safety Act and believing that you can extraterritorially start fining and threatening to incarcerate Americans for having online content and operating online in a way that's accessible to people in the British Isles. You know, that's obviously insane. There was literally they had a revolution over this. And you know, many people have said you're going to have to land troops if you want to enforce that. But parliamentary supremacy has really led Parliament to believe it can do anything. And with a sort of politically subservient monarch who will sign anything it produces, you get these strange outcomes which do fly in the face of the coronation oath. But like I said earlier, I do think that is a romantic sentiment, and I don't think it has much grounds for a challenge. In the form of judicial review or like a serious constitutional question of law as to whether joining the common market and subsequently the European Union was a breach there, at least on the grounds of the coronation oath.
Yeah, and also the time to seek redress would have been when she was still alive and we were still in the European Union. Both of those factors no longer obtained. So unless you were going to seek redress against the monarchy itself as an institution rather than the individual. But again, I don't see how that can practically be done.
You could run a limitation period from the time that the monarch has given assent to a form of essentially law via instrument from the EU, but I think that time has passed. The fact that they still have given assent to a variety of what is retained EU law could give rise to a claim under that, but I just don't think the coronation oath is the means of doing it. And I think an act after a bill has been published, which on a rolling basis disposes of by decade every piece of retained EU law, secondary legislation and primary legislation, unless you flag that it is kept, would be the way to do a Great Repeal Act. And that would basically cover any real grievance there. You know, the effect being you brought us into this thing in contravention of your oath, but I think we can basically undo the effect of it by way of an act like that, which could be done in a dozen or so pages.
All right. And then there's one final super chat, and it is from Dardy, and he says, fantastic stream. Sounds like reform could really use someone like Michael to draft legislation or policy outlines to actually bring about positive change for Britain's future. Well, yeah, I agree.
That's very kind. I'll have to pester them.
All right. Well, let's end it there. Any final words before we finish? Just to let people know where they can find you and what they'll find there.
So you can find me at MCR Rainers on Twitter. And generally speaking, I'm always commenting on these kinds of issues as they apply to current events when I can be bothered, because it's usually coming back to the same points. And then the key thing is, in the last week, I have launched my new project, which is intending to publish a raft of legislation to stabilise the ship of state, and that is rainers.org.uk, and it can be found on Twitter at Rainers Project. So that is what I will be doing over the next several months, and whatever interest and whichever political parties would like to either have assistance tailoring those or simply pilfer the content, that's basically what I'll be doing over the next several months and refining as I go.
All right. Excellent. I've really enjoyed this conversation. So, Michael, thank you for agreeing to appear. Okay, I'll be back in 10 minutes with the next guest. In the meantime, Michael Rainers, good luck with all your work. I think it's great. And thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025.
Thank you so much for having me, and all the very best.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? The Millennial NFT is a unique animated vector graphic available for just one lucky owner. The auction closes on the 30th. Make your bid today. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.